Live Line on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry, bringing you great savings on curtains and bedding. Available all year in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Live Line. Cullum O'Mungain here. You can get us 51551 by text. Joe at RTE.ie as well. Have a listen to this. The voice of Gloria, the words and music of Kris Kristofferson and Mary John Wilkins. Let's hear from the woman who brought those words to life for Irish audiences in particular, dominating the charts, I think for, was it almost 90 weeks between 1979 and 1980, Gloria?
Well, you may be right, Colm. I can't remember back that far, to be honest with you.
Flying high in the charts with that particular song. Yeah. Do you remember what attracted you to it?
Well, to tell you the truth, there's a story to that. I went over, I was doing a gospel album in with Release Records, and the producer on that had a friend in Nashville, and they invited me over to do a gospel album, just primarily gospel. But I had my songs all learned, you know. So, well, I was recording them, and this beautiful lady came up and asked me would I like to sing a song she wrote. And she had a co-writer. He says, I don't know about that. And I said, I have a lot of songs to learn, really, for tomorrow. She says, no, I think you'll like it. She took me out to her home in Brentwood and into the thing. She said, would you like to meet Chris? So I didn't notice Kristofferson, to be honest with you, at the time. He just came in. Well, he was sitting there in all his glory, and well, he's such a humble man, and I think he gave a whole definition to the word aura. He had such an aura and such a presence. He shook hands, and my John played the piano, and she sang it. So she did the music, and Chris did the lyrics. So she played it, and the next morning I went in at 10 to 10. I says, you know, I kind of, I'm not really that fond of waltzes, little did I know. 10 minutes we did it, Colm, and that was the end.
A bit of a one-take wonder, was it?
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah, it was easy. And of course, the musicians over there in Nashville, I mean, they just breathe music, you know. There's only one go. We gave it half a bit, right, and then the next thing, go for it. So
you weren't convinced initially, but when you met Kris Kristofferson, there was something about him that tipped you over the line.
Well,
was it charisma? Was it looks?
Oh, yes.
Was it
everything.
Music?
Now, don't be looking for information. He was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. But he was such, his songs, I mean, me and Bobby McGee, for the good times. I think my John had a big publishing company at the time. Now, this was more a Christian label, you know, it was the born-again Christian thing. And that's basically what it was. And I think he was probably part, he didn't say much, but that was it, really. It was when I came home, really, Colm. The Release Records heard it then, and there's a few other songs that you know, I thought would be nicer, better. But they thought that would be a hit. They released it in the north first, and it went well there, and then sort of it gathered momentum after that. So I was glad of that, Colm.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a song that's been a huge inspiration to people. It's been taken up by people struggling with addiction, for example, you know, the exhortation to take things one day at a time.
Well, that's the truth.
Has been, I think, an inspiration to people as they get up every day and work through the next 24 hours.
Especially nowadays. But I have a little thing here that I just saw on the internet a while ago. It's Kris Kristofferson wrote it. It's tell the truth, sing with passion, work with laughter, love with heart, because that's all that matters in the end. I think that says it all, doesn't it, really?
And did you ever get to go and see him live performing any of his own songs? Did you follow his career afterwards?
No, but there's of course, I mean, you know, I've been a country music fan for a long time, but some story, and I just came to my head, Colm, a while ago. I think the Furies or some of those bands were playing out in the Embankment. You wouldn't remember that.
This is up near Saggart, as you travel out the N81 up above Saggart there.
That's
the Embankment was there, yeah.
So they took Chris out for a pint afterwards, and the place was, and he went round the back. This is a story, and I probably think it's true, but they wouldn't let him in because he did knock and say Kristofferson, they said go home. So he didn't get in to have the session with the Furies after all. I said he'd like that.
Maybe it was the makings of him. Maybe that could have been.
Maybe
he'd see that as a fork in the road. Maybe he had an early night that night.
He seemed very centred, and a man like For the Good Times. What else did he have? Why Me Lord, I did as well, Colm recorded that. I'm just trying to think of some. Sure, he's hundreds of songs, and you know, really, who's going to fill his shoes? The same as Sandy.
Yeah, where would you
there?
Kind of put him in the pantheon of country music? Because he came, obviously, you know, he stood on his own two feet in his political and other views, and I suppose he has a record of music that speaks for itself as well.
Absolutely, with a little bit out of the usual genre, I'd say. You know, when you had Carmina's daughter, you had Loretta Lynn. They were singing about. She was writing songs about. But he did have a little political stance, and I mean, when he put his arms around Sinead O'Connor, I don't think with Kris Kristofferson, it was absolutely the love of his lyrics, the love of meeting people. I wouldn't have thought he would just say, I'll do this song because it's going to be a hit. You know, he was authentic. That's what I think.
I'm reading online about him today. I think he went to third level he was at third level in the States, and then he went to England. But music was only a side gig. He wanted to be a novelist to begin with, and the music was kind of something that he thought might support him in his writing.
Yeah, he was multi-talented. I mean, he could have done and did everything. But there you go. I think it's just. As I said, who's going to fill the shoes? Who's left? I don't know. Willie Nelson. Well, Sandy was saying that Willie Nelson's still around. But, you know, definitely I'll be listening to some of Kristofferson's songs now tonight, going over them.
Yeah, and do you think there's a kind of a realness to the lyrics, you know, listening to Sunday Morning Coming Down? It sounds like the lived experience of somebody who's...
But he did. I think, yes, he did. He was... My John picked him up brushing out a bar in Nashville, and he was selling his early songs, like for the Good Times, and Mary John bought them. I think she bought one for $10, 50, whatever. And as it happened then, he bought them back from her. I think he was part of her business acumen, and I think he got millions for the song. So that's the way it was. It worked like that. But I mean, he definitely was the real thing. He was so authentic. And
is that what Nashville is like? Are there many, you know, songwriters there who, you know, like waiters in Hollywood? But back in the day when you were over, were there, you know, every guy sweeping a bar floor, were they aspiring musicians going to Nashville to try and make it?
It was more organic then. I mean, my son now, Paul, he was over there, and he said it's more like Taylor Swift. It's like Nashville, you know. It's not like Nashville. It's like Vegas. It's just all different. But I have to say, and there was other singers too, Irish singers that got over there in the 70s, 74, 73. You know, it was just in one of those offices, I remember a day, and I was looking out the window, and he said, this guy that was working there, he said, oh, there's old George. And George, it was George Jones going off to the pub. You don't get to see anything as good as that. It was very Music Row. It was Music Row in it. And it was people, you know, you would meet the waitresses, absolutely. Everybody was there and all wonderful wee bars along Music Row. There were bars that were playing amazing stuff, amazing artists, amazing things. But it was the luck of the draw, Colm. You know, it really wasn't, you know.
And what did he have that kind of, you know, I mean, country music people would pride themselves on being no BS type of people. You know, they admire authenticity. He seems to have had that in spades.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it was, you know, that was what he was. He didn't have to try. I don't think he didn't have to try to do it. He was it. You know, he just stood there, and his actual presence, he had a great aura, a great presence. So it came from his heart. It came from his heart. I think if he never made anything, he enjoyed it. He enjoyed meeting people. And I think that's the way it has to be, you know, to be as big as he was and as loved as he was. He was telling the truth. And that other, I'm trying to think of the other song now. Make It Through the Night. I did that while me lords. A few more, there's hundreds more. But he was the real thing. He was the real deal, Colm. No question about it.
And people liked a bit of mischief about him as well. He had that air about him too.
Of course. I didn't notice that now, Colm.
I heard Sandy Kelly telling the story on the News at One there about, you know, it was one actually Johnny Cash told about him landing his helicopter on the front lawn in order to get his tape
that.
Under the nose. Kris Kristofferson, he doubted afterwards that Johnny Cash was even in. But anyway, the way Johnny Cash told it was that Kris Kristofferson spilled out of the helicopter with the tape in one hand and a beer in
cowboy.
The other. But it lost nothing.
Yeah, sure.
It lost nothing in the telling.
Not a tawdry. He was authentic. He was the real thing. And I think people loved that. But a very intelligent man too. You know, he's a one-off, you know. And we'll be listening to his music, I'd say, for a long time, Colm.
Frank Buckley, it wasn't just the lyrics that touched people. Christofferson had a real effect, and he has inspired you to do some work here in Ireland.
Absolutely. Yeah, I worked with him in the 90s, early 90s, when he was over in Ireland doing a couple of tours. And the first time I met him, actually, there was a big limousine, just what that lady was talking about, you know, being modest and just down to earth. There was a big limousine at the airport for him, and I was in a minibus for the band, you know. And he came running across the car park saying, hey, do you mind if I come and join you guys? I wouldn't be able for that big car, he said, behind me. And there was a big kind of limo waiting for him, you know. He said, can I ride with you? And I said, yeah, on one condition. He said, what's that? I said, don't start singing. You're a great actor, but, you know, I question your singing. So that was the first introduction I had with him, you know. But he was a great guy.
Right,
absolutely great guy. I'm over here in Italy at the moment. And Ken, my colleague, rang her, texted me this morning to say he passed. I was just thinking of him the other day, actually, you know. Go ahead.
Yeah, what was your reaction when you heard that this morning? That, I mean, you'd met him, he seemed very down to earth, but, you know, you mightn't have been as much of a fan of the music as the acting, although I detect you're saying that slightly, ever so slightly, tongue-in-cheek.
Absolutely. No, as a person, I'm on talking now. As a person, he was really nice. He was really nice to me. He was, you know, he was very conscious of things around him, you know, which struck me because, you know, he was always in court. And even when we were coming down from the airport and he seen the kids on the horses, you know, he was asking about them, you know. And I was explaining to him that it's real culture here. Now, this is back in the 90s, Colm, you know.
And the kids you're passing by, is this out around the Finglas area when you're coming?
Well, Finglas, Ballymun area, yeah. And, you know, he was saying that, you know, he had a love for horses and that, you know. And, you know, I was saying just, you know, that unfortunately there's nothing there available for kids. They get a horse like you get a dog for Christmas. They put them in a lift up to their 14th floor and they'd have them in the bedroom and they lived with their horses. They loved their horses. And I was just explaining about all that sort of stuff that, you know, instead of trying to promote them and trying to educate them, that we're actually taking the horses off them and bringing them into these horse pounds, which are worse, actually.
What did he make of the situation you told him when you were filling him in on how the kids, you
he
know...
He was flabbergasted, he came back really quickly with it. And he said, well, why don't they educate them? And I said, ah, Chris, welcome to Ireland type of thing, you know? No, he said, serious. And we got into this conversation about a project that he was involved in the States in relation to kids that, you know, minors that, you know, they bring them in, they educate them, they tell them everything about horses and, you know, like, for example, you know, how not, you know, in their early stages of growth, a horse, you cannot ride a horse until it's, you know, nearly 2 years of age type of thing, you know, because of the structure of it, the bone structure and all that. And all that sort of stuff he was saying. I said, look, you know, telling that to the kids here. He said, well, has anybody kind of, you know, tried it? Is there anything like that here? And I said, no, there's not. And he said, well, it's 7-up. And I did.
And did, it was he, the first, did the, he give you a few quid to help you on the way?
No, but he gave me his name to put to it. And then I was able to write to a man called, which you're probably all aware of, a guy called Lester Pickett.
Oh, yeah.
And I sent a letter over with, you know, Chris's blessing to try and encourage him. And he straight back to me straight away. And he became the second patron of the Dublin School of Equine Studies.
All right.
And so there was Chris Christofferson and Lester, you know.
Ken McHugh, you were name checked there by Frank. So you got on board as well. When did you come on board with getting this thing off the ground?
Yeah, well, Frank and myself were already involved in the Smithfield Horse Fair, trying to put a bit of order on that, you know, put a shape on it. And just as Frank said, a pony jumped out in front of them, and Chris was, you know, obviously gave us the idea for the corral project. And two of them were set up in Dublin, one in Ballymun and the other in Cherry Orchard. And the one in Cherry Orchard is still up and running, which is great. But the fact that he became the patron then, as Frank said, we were able to snare in Lester Pickett. It was interesting because Lester Pickett wrote to us, and he had his, at the end of the letter, he had his tax number, you know. That's funny. And after that, then we were able to bring in Princess High of Jordan. She came on board. And the whole thing took off.
Right, and Christofferson's willingness to let his name be used unlocked all of that, you reckon?
Absolutely. Because he was our main patron. And then it opened up then. And Frank then, you know, he supported the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and the Palestinians as well. And as a result then, he was persona non grata in the United States for a long time. He wasn't getting any gigs. And Frank then organized a presentation up in the ambassadors, the U.S. ambassadors, Jane Kennedy Smith, who's an ambassador, up in her residence in Phoenix Park. And Frank presented Chris with a horse's head made out of Waterford crystal. And it was that was him back in the fold then, you know. It's great.
Right, so he was kind of out of favour. I think he'd been vocal, I think, in opposing American policy in Central America under President Reagan. And then Reagan's successor, George Bush Sr., had been the head of the CIA under Reagan. So he probably wouldn't have... Yeah. He probably wouldn't have been a big fan either. Although Chris Christofferson, I think, began life in Texas in Bush's home state, but obviously they may have agreed on geography, but little else.
He was totally against the military industrial complex and made various statements about that.
And did you have many dealings with them over? I mean, you had his name, but did he check back in? Did you have many dealings with them over the years?
Yeah, he would have been. We would have posted details of the developments and that, and he was very happy to see we were getting on. And unfortunately, the Smithfield Horse Fair is no longer. It's run a year now. And so, you know, the fact that the School of Equine Studies was set up was a major move, and it was thanks to him, really. Yeah.
Can I come in there, Colin?
Sure, Frank. Was he back and forth then, you know, over the years, whether he was gigging or travelling in Europe?
Yes, we came back to Ireland a few times on tours that I worked with him, you know. That was just the first one. The second one, when he came back again, we did a north move in Belfast, you know. And I remember when because he had a band with him, and his daughter was also with him. And we did a northern tour, you know. I mean, they were flying out of Belfast. And I'll never forget it, because when we went into the arrivals, now this is in 1991, 92, around that time. And there was soldiers everywhere, you know, and it was kind of freaking out the band. And, you know, Timothy McVeigh, do you remember that, the guy that the bombing over in America? That had just happened, you know?
The
Oklahoma bomb, exactly. And there was all that kind of tension, and there was all that kind of... But when the guys went in, they were really worried. They were, you know, trying to put in their equipment into the arrivals there. And they were surrounded by soldiers. And Chris walked into the room, and it just changed, because the atmosphere in it was that the guys were obviously scared of the soldiers. The soldiers were hovering around, you know, and they weren't very nice to them, you know. They were kind of, what's in that case? Open that case. What's this? And to be honest, I'm not being rude about it, but it was none of their business, because they were there as security, but not for airport security. So these guys didn't know what was going on. But what I did notice when Chris walked in, it completely changed. The atmosphere changed.
Right, because they recognized him, and it was a kind of name recognition,
even,
or he just had a way about him?
I don't think it was because of his name or who he was, or they recognized him as Chris Christofferson. I think just when he arrived in, he kind of calmed everything down. I went over, started talking to the soldiers, and was just with the cases, and you could feel the atmosphere calming down, you know.
Right. Of course, he'd been in the army himself. His grandfather, his own dad
was a helicopter pilot. And that's why I just heard the ladies that spoke about when he went into Johnny Cash into the studio, and he landed a helicopter in his backyard, and that story is true. Heard that story, and I was asking Chris. And he said, absolutely. He said, nobody would listen to him. They thought I was rubbish. And as I said, Chris, at the airport, we won't go back there. I said, but yeah, he told me the story of that, that he did land in the back.
I think the reason he had access to a helicopter, the reason he had an access to the helicopter at the time was because he was doing nixers on an oil rig nearby down in Louisiana to make a bit of money while he was trying to fund himself for songwriting. So we'd fly up at the weekend. Have his tapes and drop them off.
Yeah,
I think
he wrote
"Help Me Make It Through the Night" on an oil platform while he was down there waiting for a helicopter job.
That's exactly. But you know, when on his second, when he had arrived, I was messing around at the time. I was just messing around with painting and that, you know. Now, I remember, I'll never forget it, because it was just, I was getting my poetry done one day, and that's how I discovered I could do a little bit of painting. I was bored, you know, and with my finger I got actually a Kellogg's cornflakes box. And decided about with my finger I was painting, just messing, just joking and just, you know, sketching out. And anyway, some guy came in that evening to the flat and said, who's the painter, who's the artist? So I framed it, and Chris was came into my apartment one night at one of his stores, and he seen it, and he commented on it, you know. So when he was leaving, I left the framed painting for him. As a gift, you know.
It was a picture of him. It wasn't a self-portrait now yourself.
No,
it was a picture.
No,
it was one of Chris Christopherson.
No, it wasn't a portrait.
Right.
No. It was scribbly. Colourful and scribbly. That's all I remember it. But he commented on it. So I left it in the jury's hotel for him, you know, for a gift. And I got a phone call off the usher in the jury's hotel to say there was an envelope down in the reception for me to collect, you know. So when I opened, there was $1,000 in it. And then a little note saying you can't put the value on art.
Right. Have you flogged any paintings on cornflakes boxes since?
I haven't. I would have for a minimum of $1,000, you know. But I did get into painting. Wow. I did have exhibitions, and I did a bit of work after that, you know. But no, just back to Chris. He was an amazing guy. He had this thing about him, you know. He could talk about presidents, he could talk to kids, you know, and he could just go down to the Ballymun and sit down with the kids and have a chat with them.
Yeah, what did the kids
make
of him?
And he was very excused. Oh, they were delighted. I mean, they didn't know who he was, you know what I mean? He was just a big, tall American guy that, you know, sounded great, and, you know, and people were, you know, all hovering around him, so they reckoned, oh, he must be famous, and they were all over him. Well, I wouldn't think they knew who he was, you know.
Ken, do you remember what his reaction was when he got the horse's head?
Frank, I'll tell you more about that, because
it wasn't like the scene from The Godfather, was it? He didn't react with horror when he was presented with the horse's head.
I'll tell you that now in a second, Callum.
Your crystal head. But look, just before I go, what's the impact he had on particularly the next generation is amazing, because my granddaughter is now learning his songs. So it carries on, you know. It's not although it's very sad today, like, his, you know, his legacy is there, and that's really important. The songs are so powerful. They're classics.
All right, well, we're going to hear a bit more about Chris Christopherson and the impact he had on people here in Ireland after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Cullum O'Mungain here. Karina Malloy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. How are you?
Good. You thought you were dreaming when you met him. Is that it? You're trying to... Did this really happen?
That's it, yeah. Did it really happen? Because when I think of it now, it was just incredible what I got to do. I got to walk up to the stage and shake Johnny Cash's hand and Chris Christopherson's hand after the concert. And I watched them play in Brick for the Border. And... was that really? Because you just wouldn't be able to do that now. The access wouldn't allow you now.
And break
to be
the
able to shake hands with them.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a lively venue for line dancing, and where many romances blossomed late in the night. But it's just not far from Grafton Street, the back of the Stephen's Green Centre there in South Dublin City Centre.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
And you went along. And, who were you there with?
Funny you should ask that. I got two tickets, and I was supposed to go with my roommate, but we had a row a few days beforehand, and she refused to come with me. So I said, oh, okay, then, well, I'll go by myself. I don't know I probably just kept the spare ticket, or maybe I gave it away. But I remember storming out that night and slamming the front door and saying, oh, well, I'll go by myself, and I'm really glad I did, because I really enjoyed it, because I went more so to see Johnny Cash, because I grew up with Johnny Cash being played in the house. My dad was a great fan. And, of course, I knew all of Chris Christopherson as well. But, thinking back now, it was just incredible to get so close to them both.
Yeah, and do you remember
just
it?
Stand there and listen to them. I remember it. I remember shaking their hands.
Yeah, what was it like?
They were putting away their guitars, and they just stopped. Now, I wasn't privileged. I wasn't the only one running up. But they stopped with everyone and shook their hands and said, "Hi, how are you? Did you enjoy the concert? And thanks very much." And
I'd say you made sure to tell the roommate afterwards, did you?
Oh, I certainly did, yeah. I'll be ringing her tonight.
It was all resolved, was it? You're back friends again?
Oh, absolutely, we were back friends.
Do you remember what the row was about?
A few days later. No, I can't remember. No, no.
Isn't it just
no.
as well?
I'll ask her. She has a fantastic memory, so I'll ask her.
All right. All right, thanks, Karina. Yeah, Frank Greeley, you met him more than once.
I did. I was blessed to meet him 3 times, which is amazing, really, you know.
Yeah, what were the circumstances?
The first time, it was a typical Irish situation. I knew a man who knew a man. A friend of mine, Brendan Hackett, knew the promoter who was bringing him in I think it was the Mean Fiddler when it was in Dublin there. And
in Camden Street.
That's right, yeah. And we got to meet him, and he was doing a sound check, and he went through a number of his songs nearly the whole way through them. And then he sat down with us for about a half an hour, and we had a wonderful conversation. And, you know, we talked about, he was into running, and I involved in the Irish Runner magazine. He loved talking about running. He ran nearly every day, and he loved talking about boxing. He fought Golden Gloves in America, and, of course, about songwriting as well, which I had a great interest in. And then later on, I met him in Cavan one time he was back, and then he played the Olympia. And the time I met him first, we got a lovely photograph done together. And later on, I published a book called Running Full Circle, and I included it. And I was able to give him the book as a gift as well, which was lovely.
And did he remember any of the previous occasions that
he'd
mentioned?
He talked about it. He said the first time we met, we had a link as well that I went to college in Johnson City in East Tennessee, and he had played there once. But I really wanted to meet him that time, but security was too much. I didn't know a man who knew a man over there. So that was that situation. But, you know, his passing, it's amazing that about a week ago, I do an event with Athletics Ireland up in the Phoenix Park in November called Remembrance Run. And I was doing this, we were picking out some of the songs. And there's a song he wrote for his kids called From Here to Forever. And I picked that, like, it was so poignant last night when I heard the news that he had died, because I'd always have such precious memories of those meetings. The first meeting was half an hour. The other ones were short, but they were impactful as well. Like, he was interested in what I was doing, and he's just a lovely, lovely man. And as he said, you know, love is the last thing to go. That was one of his things, and, you know, I really, really hit me in the gut last night when I came in from a music session, and I saw the words up on Facebook. I didn't believe it first with all that goes on Facebook, but it really, really, really brought me back to those lovely, lovely times with him, you know.
All right. Well, it's interesting you were talking to him about sport, because I think he first reached national prominence in the US, actually, as a result of sport. He appeared, according to what's written about him online anyway, in Sports Illustrated, in American football, track and field, and rugby. He himself and his classmates were big into rugby in college, and they revived a rugby club in 1958 that's still in existence to this day. I think it's Claremont College's rugby club.
And that people probably don't really, may have not known it, but almost every day he went for a run. And Willie Nelson is his great mate. They're both regular runners, even well into their older, longer years. Like, they were still running in their 70s and late 70s.
All right. Francie Conway, you sent him a song of yours.
No, I didn't, Colm. Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, yeah.
Really enjoying the show. No, I didn't. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the thing that I just sent you for a bit of crack there.
I haven't seen it. I haven't heard it yet. I await with bated breath, but go on.
No,
what's your connection there?
Just totally, totally randomly. I received the package in the post maybe 12 years ago, 10, 12 years ago. And it was a photograph of Chris and it said, "A Drop of Irish Rain, loved the song, Francie, Peace and Love, Chris Christopherson."
And this was
and then I went to find out how this song had come onto the lap of Chris Christopherson, and he heard it on radio in America. And it's a wacky kind of a song that featured Ronnie Drew, Finbar Fury, the Dutch violinist, Sear de Jong. And he obviously took to the wackiness of the song and he really responded to it. And it was like, I have to say, I was quite taken back. I was very honoured from a songwriter like him, because from when I was a kid, I would have listened to his songs. I remember hearing a song, I don't know, Colm, if you ever heard it, called Jesus Was a Capricorn. Do you remember
that? I know
that?
The title of it. I don't know that. I'm not familiar with the
but,
song,
I mean,
though.
At the time, it was way out there. It was like Jesus was a Capricorn. He ate organic foods. He believed in love and peace and never wore no shoes. You know, and he was doing things outside of the box. And, you know, being a rocker, to kind of, you know, do a Chris Christopherson song, you change the arrangement. But the thing is, there was his songs were always there, and you know, and they always will be there. I think he's left a huge legacy, and I'm just honoured. My only regret is that Ronnie had passed away when I received the package, and the funny thing about the package was all it said was Francie Conway, Dublin, Ireland, and it found me.
Right, well, he's short of landing his helicopter on your front lawn, he probably couldn't have had a bigger impact on you.
I mean, that's pretty cool, though, isn't it? A bit scary, though, that somebody can just send something to Ireland and it gets there. You know, I think it's so cool. And you can imagine my surprise when I opened the envelope and I went, oh, my God. I was really, really taken back, you know.
Did you know it was him, or did you think it was a joke at first?
No, I knew, because I know friends of his, and I know that friends of his would have been listening to my records from the 80s, from To the Edge of Time and One Night in Amsterdam and all that kind of period. So I knew there was a connection there. But I mean, you know, it was just a random gesture, and from one songwriter to another. And I think it was just very, very special of him, to be honest with you.
And are you still writing yourself at the moment?
We've another album. We've been working on it for about a year, Colm, and we're due for release, I think, in spring 2025. The guys in London told me.
All right. Well, the best of luck with it, Francie.
And well done on the show today. And everybody who's on, it's so wonderful to hear Chris remembered in such a way. Thank you. And thank you for giving me the call.
Not at all. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. It's good to get as many yarns as possible about Chris Christopherson covering, I mean, as you know, his own generosity in touching base with you, just to make sure you know that he'd appreciated your song.
You know, and as I said, like, I know that Ronnie Drew was a big fan of Chris Christopherson. And so it was bittersweet, because I would have loved to have just gone into the car and drove straight down to Greystones to my buddy to show him what arrived from Chris, you know.
Yeah. Fiona Whelan Prine, Chris Christopherson was also a fan of John Prine.
Yes, hi. Yes, it's very sad today. We've lost a good friend. John and Chris were friends for a long, 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 long time. John, of course, knew of Chris and about Chris and had admired him well before he met him. But I was just telling your researcher there that really John always credited Chris with really giving John a career. John was a very young man. He had just come back from Germany, having been enlisted in the war, and he was a mailman in Chicago and was writing songs on his mail route. And one night he'd gotten up and sang some at a local bar in West Chicago, and the owner of the bar said, "I'll give you a job 5 nights a week if you have more songs." And so, you know, I mean, all of this is well documented, but John basically packed it in at the post office and sang five nights a week at the Fifth Peg in Chicago. And he was very happy doing that. He was making a lot more money than he did at the post office. And he was, as he would have said himself, was able to sleep late in the morning. And then he would sing all night. And he was a very, John was very close with another great Chicago songwriter called Steve Goodman. And so Steve and John were already friends at that point. But Steve had been given the opportunity to open for Kris Kristofferson. This would have been back in 1969, 1970, 1971. I think it was around 1970 was when he did these shows with Kristofferson in Chicago. Steve did. And the story goes that Steve just kept bending Chris's ear, like every night, saying, if you think I'm good, you have to hear my buddy. You've got to come hear my buddy. You've got to hear John, because his songs are like nobody else's. And so John had finished playing one night at the bar and was literally lying down on one of the sofas, you know, in the buffet thing, waiting to be paid. And it was late. It was probably like 12:30 or 1 in the morning. And next thing walked in the door was Steve Goodman with Kris Kristofferson and a couple of the guys from the band, Chris's band. And John literally thought he was having a dream. But Chris asked him to sing some songs for him.
Right, so he'd finished up for the night. The gig was over. The bar was as good as shut. And he was stretching out, having done his night's performance. And Kris Kristofferson, I suppose if you're ever going to get up and do an encore, Kris Kristofferson's the guy to get you to do it.
Yeah, I mean, the chairs were all upside down on the tables, and John just grabbed a chair or a stool and went, sat back up on the stage, and he sang. You know, John would already have written, like, his first record then, but it was, of course, it hadn't been recorded, but he'd written Hello in There and Don's and Lydia and Angel of Montgomery and Souvenirs and all of these classic songs. And so he played a whole bunch of songs for Chris.
No pressure, John.
And and John said it was like there was silence for like about 5 seconds. I remember John telling the story, and then Chris said, you know, wow, he said, would you mind singing all of those again? I think he wanted to be sure that what he was hearing was real. And so he sang them again, and Chris was just blown away. And so
And in those 5 seconds of silence between when he finished and Chris asked him to sing it again, did John ever tell you what was going through his head, how he was feeling?
Well, John was tired. I mean, John played five nights a week, two shows. So, you know, and he probably had a few beers after work. And so he was, you know, I think he was stunned, honestly, because he was a huge fan of Kristofferson's.
I mean, that just doesn't happen to most people, you know, that kind of, you know, one of your musical heroes walks in and makes a career-changing move in your life.
Yeah. I think really, you know, it's how I have always thought about John's career. And maybe Chris, I can't speak for Chris and Lisa and how they would have, you know, drawn the story around Chris's career, but certainly to me, it always was the American dream. I mean, it was, you know, where else in the world would something that unlikely ever happen? But it happened in Chicago. It happened to John Prine, who was just a kid from Maywood, Illinois.
Right. I read that. I read that John looked down at his guitar and just thought, well, buddy, it's you or me. It's now or never. You and me, it's now or never, or something to that effect.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, knowing John, how I knew him, John was very, very, I mean, John was still a shy man all the way up to when he passed. He was not a gregarious person, but he was very shy when he was younger. So he played the songs again. And anyway, you know, a month or two goes by, and John and Steve Goodman were being brought to New York to play a showcase, or to do a show or do some press or something. People had started hearing about them. And it just so happened when they got in, John, being an avid newspaper reader, bought all of the local newspapers, the New York papers, and saw that Kristofferson was playing down at the Bitter End in the Village. And so himself and Steve, with their two little suitcases, got in a taxi and went straight down to the bitter end. And when Chris heard that John was there, he stopped the show halfway through and told the audience that they were about to hear something really special. It's a little emotional thinking about it, honestly. John got up.
Take your time.
Yeah, John got up and sang some songs, and the place went crazy. And John didn't know it, but Ahmed Herdigan from Atlantic Records was in the audience. He owned Atlantic Records and was one of the big producers there. And he was there, and John was brought to the office next day at Atlantic and given a record deal.
I mean, as you mentioned, Steve Goodman there, he'd be well known for the city of New Orleans, you know, worth recognising in his own right. But I mean, it does show the power of good people, doesn't it? A loyal friend and fellow musician who, unselfishly pushed John on the basis of, you know, his talents and obviously and the bond between the two of them. But for Chris Christopherson to eventually, you know, give in to the nagging, give him a listening ear, and then to show the generosity to get him up on stage. I mean, I know you mentioned the American dream, but it's about good people doing right by each other as well.
Yeah, it's that, and it's the power of songwriting at its best. You know, it moves, songs move the world. They still move all of us. That first record that John wrote back in between 1968 and 1970, that was released just almost 50 years ago, actually, this month. You know, those songs were the songs that John still played every night right up until his last concert in Paris, February 2020.
Well, I mean, he had a tough audience.
Yeah,
Chris Christopherson. I mean, if his songs were going to blow Chris Christopherson away to, you know, listen to John and ask him for an encore on that night and then get him up on stage, he wasn't, you know, he wouldn't have put his name, you know, to any old guitar strummer.
Oh, no.
It was the quality of the music that won him over.
That's right.
And how are you doing now, Fiona? I mean, on a day like this, you know, you hear the passing of Chris Christopherson and it kind of, I suppose, brings back your own loss to you. It's another connection, I suppose, gone with your love.
Connection, yeah. Well, not to go into too many personal details, but we lost our family home in Florida last week.
I'm sorry to hear
with
that.
With the flood, with the hurricane. And so we were just, I was just getting myself reoriented. And the news came through, and it really floored me for a little while. I mean, I just, because all the memories come flooding back. And I was on with Lisa Christopherson, who's just an incredible woman. And we've all became very close friends over the years. Chris, Lisa, John, and I, we were good friends.
And how was he, you know, how did you find him as a person? Obviously, he was a musical colleague of John's. You became friends. But what did you like about him?
Honestly, what I was thinking about yesterday was I loved watching he and John together. There was a mutual love, admiration, and in later years, they would both kind of tear up when they were together, just sitting looking at each other. We met them, I guess it would have been in 2018 maybe was the last time, or the beginning of 2019 was the last time we saw them. And Chris told John that the Tree of Forgiveness was one of the finest records he'd ever heard. And he got all teary and misty-eyed because they've had such history together. I mean, more than 50 years of, you know, life, love, death, friends, songwriting. I mean, they'd shared a lot together.
Yeah, they'd seen the ups and downs of a very harsh industry as well.
All of it.
You're in, you're out, you're up, you're down. It's not an easy life.
Yeah. No, I mean, over the decades, music tastes change and people change and the industry changes willy-nilly, you know. Whatever the fads are and whatever the trends are of the moment, there were many, many, many incredible people left behind for whole decades of their lives, only to be, brought back around again and given the honors that they deserved. I think for Chris, even though there was a time when he didn't play as many shows in the US, I think I heard you guys talk about that earlier, and it was just as much about the times, right, and the kind of music and the industry as it was about politics for Chris, because he also was a movie star, you know. I mean, he did a lot of films.
Yeah, Star Is Born. People would remember, you know, obviously that, you know, and more recently, Planet of the Apes. He was in three of the famous director Sam Peckinpah's movies as well. So, I mean, I think a lot of the 70s, he concentrated on his acting when things maybe weren't clicking as much musically.
And, you know, it's interesting here because the film industry would probably still trump the music industry. I hate to use that word, by the way. But in terms of, you know, once you've been in the in the movies and films, then your music career, if you are a musician, sort of rides alongside that. So Chris was always had a level of success. John fell completely not out of favor. I mean, his fans always loved him, but he was dropped by his record label back in the 1981, John would have been dropped by his record label because he wasn't of the moment, you know.
And would they have been in touch during that time? I mean, is there a kind of a mutual support amongst good friends where, you know, Chris respected him as a songwriter. So is there kind of a bit of a morale boost every so often?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I don't want to paint a dark picture and say that a lot of these people didn't work at all and they didn't, you know, I mean, by any stretch of the imagination, these were wealthy people. These men had worked hard and had written great songs and had made a lot of money. But just in terms of, you know, numbers of people coming out to the concerts, numbers of records being sold. But John and Chris toured many times together over the years. I was trying to remember, actually, yesterday, they did a festival together, and I think it was at a race course down in County Waterford. I'm going to have to dig up the archive.
There was one that was organised. If you're talking about, there was one I think in the 1990s. That would you be talking about the 90s? I think there was one organised by I think Vince Power, who ran the Mean Fiddler.
Yeah. Yes, I think that might have been it. Actually, that might have been it. But we had a great time when we were in Ireland together. I mean, we'd been in Ireland together a few times, but just those memories really stand out because Chris loved Ireland. He loved the countryside. He loved the people. He loved the peace. He loved the music. And we had a lot of fun.
You weren't at that gig in Break for the Border that Carina Molloy was talking about, were you? In Dublin, Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson playing together. I think 1993.
That was around. Yeah, that was around the time of the Highwaymen. I saw many of those concerts. That was the year that I moved to America. That wasn't Carina Molloy from Ardragh, Donegal.
It is. Yeah, no. She's on the other line there. Do you want to say hello to her?
That's my friend. I mean, that's my childhood friend.
Say hello to her. She's on the other line, listening to you.
Carina.
Hi Fiona, how are you? Hi, the researcher was after asking me, is she going to remember you? I said, I hope so.
How could I not remember? I mean, that's my whole childhood. We lived on the same road in Ardragh.
Jan and our mothers are great friends. That's right.
Yeah. And I know you lost yours not too long ago.
I'm using your mother now as a mother because I keep visiting her. We keep missing each other when you come down to visit your mum and you go
know,
to your
house. And I'm there a lot these days.
You're there a lot, so we must catch up.
Sisters, I would love that. One of my sisters just sent through a photograph because, of course, I have, as Carina knows, I have my mom and five sisters. There's seven women in our family. We lost my dad when I was very young. And We were all big, huge music fans. I mean, I was a John Prine fan long before I ever met him. My mother was a massive Kris Kristofferson fan, and I remember she and I going to Kitty Begg's cinema to see A Star Is Born. I was a young teenager, but it was such a joy for me to get my mother to meet Chris and my sisters to meet him, and they got to hang out with him after a show in Dublin, and we have some great pictures from that night. So, yeah, there's lots of connections.
Yeah, lots of memories.
Well, I hope you'll exchange numbers and catch up soon. Maybe Fiona, when you're swinging through our draw, you might look up Karina and you can go over the memories. And it turns out your shared love of Kris Kristofferson.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
I'll be over next month. Actually, I'm coming
okay,
over.
Great.
All right, catch up then. We're back. We're back after this with a few to hear a bit more.
Bye, Fiona. Hi.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungain here, Sean O'Hanney, Conas the Corsi. Kris Kristofferson and the news of his death. How did you feel about it?
I was shocked. I knew, he was in his 80s and that, but a real legend, an icon of music has passed. And I think there's a feel-good factor about him, not just as a singer, but as a human being and the type of person he was. You know, like John Prine, he wrote songs from his heart rather than for the charts or anything like that. I just feel, he has such an interesting story. He's the son of a U.S. Army general, and his career was mapped out for him to be an Air Force officer. He was a captain, and he did his Army Ranger training. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He spent a while in the UK in university, and then he threw it all away, you could say, to become a singer-songwriter.
Well, that's certainly how his family felt about it anyway. I think they think there was a bit of tension over his choice to give up a career as an officer in the Army and go into singer-songwriter.
And to be a janitor in a recording studio so that he could learn his craft and hang out and get to know people. And of course, that's where he learned to pilot a helicopter in the Army. And he had lots of similarities with John Prine, both ex-Army guys, and that he did John Prine, you might say, a lot of favors, bringing him to public attention, as Johnny Cash did for him. And the famous story, which is well known, I'm sure, the song Sunday Morning Coming Down, when Johnny Cash was on TV and had a program, a weekly program, the powers that be asked him not to sing Wishing Lord That I Was Stoned. They wanted him to sing something else. So they said, sing something else. And Kristofferson was in the audience. And Johnny Cash sang the song. And he sang Wishing Lord That I Was Stoned, which was a big thing for conservative American television at the time, you know.
And your own connection, I mean, you're a former managing editor for music in Radio Na Gaeltacht. I mean, you probably saw a lot of records coming through your hands at the time. Where would you rank Kris Kristofferson in the overall pile in terms of his merits?
Oh, he's one of the top people. I mean, John Prine is another favourite of mine. I have to say, I saw him sing many times. I never got the opportunity to see Chris, but if you think of the whole Highwayman thing, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, and himself. They were tired of the whole Nashville industry, I think. Nashville became not so much about giving an opportunity to good singer-songwriters as the cash register and how many units of sales you were doing. And a lot of them took off to Austin, Texas, where they had a new listenership, a mixture of hippies and farmers, as they said.
Admire his willingness to buck the trend and kick against the pricks, do you?
Very, very much so. And, not only as a singer, but as an actor. There was a famous film, Heaven's Gate. It's 4 hours long in the unedited version. And it depicts the moneyed society of America in the mid-19th century and how they used and abused immigrants, the whole thing. And he was the star of that. and it took a long time to make. It nearly broke one of the companies, the film companies. Christopherson was a persona non grata for a while after that, because in America, it doesn't take much to be given the label that you're a lefty or far left or hard left. It's like a tag that a lot of money people don't like. And I had to say, I admired Christopherson for his stance in taking parts that were not popular in a film depicting America as a country of the haves and have nots. So not just as a singer, but as a person, as an actor. And all his songs depicted, you know, the poor, drug people, hippies, children with no money. He was really a poet that put words to music. He wasn't the sweetest singer in the world, but the heart that came with his lyrics and songs. He wasn't just singing a nice rhyme and a nice melody. They were very deep songs. And I think, you know, it's only in the recent years that a lot of people who may have thought, like Johnny Cash for a while, was out of date, that his songs will stand the test of time, and it's poetry in motion.
All right, Sean, Gramina Mahagat, we'll be back with more after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we heard from Sean O'Hanley before the break that he regretted never seeing Kris Kristofferson live. The same couldn't be said for you, Elena Smith. You did see him live.
Certainly did. Hi, Colin. I saw him a couple of times. Well, I saw him here once in the Olympia, and like John Prine, I'd seen him and funnily enough, had tickets to see John, obviously during lockdown. But in 2019, myself and my sister took a flight over to London to see Barbara Streisand's gig, and she was being supported by Kris Kristofferson and Brian Ferry. And it was a stunningly beautiful day. But what surprised me about it was that Kris came out first, and I thought, like, he's, you know, he'll be kind of headlining after Barbara, but he was the first gig at kind of 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I didn't know at this point in time that he was in somewhat ill health. And he was kind of failing as he walked onto stage. He seemed a bit weak and whatever, but as soon as he started his set, he was absolutely on top of it. And just, you know, we were just loving every moment. But the funny thing was that, let's say Barbara Streisand's new audience or more recent audience wouldn't be big fans of Kris Kristofferson. There was a huge gay contingent, and a lot of the guys around us had no idea of the songs. They had never heard of me and Bobby McGee, and they couldn't sing along. And we were kind of, and you could see him actually looking at all these people right up at the front, these wonderful young people who had arrived to probably queue for hours to be at the front of the stage for when Barbara came on.
He had starred with her in A Star Is Born before, so they were joint movie stars. For anyone who is a deep Barbara Streisand fan and knew her filmography, they would have at least known who Kris Kristofferson was as an actor.
But it was funny that there didn't seem to be any recognition about the songs, and they were really enjoying them, but they didn't know one lyric. But anyway, he did his set, which was fantastic, and then off he went. And Brian Ferry did his set. And then later on in the evening, Barbara came out, and she was obviously as spectacular, as wonderful as she always was. But she brought him out on stage. So we kind of, myself and my sister, kind of reckoned that he had rested in between. She brought him, but she had to lead him out by the hand onto the stage up to the mic at that time of the evening. And so it would have been kind of 9 or 10 o'clock, getting close to the end of her gig. And she did have to prompt him they sang one verse of Evergreen together. She had to prompt him with the words. And it was quite striking, because I'd seen him in the Olympia here not too many years before that, and he was in fine health and fine voice and whatever. But it really startled me to see him failing, because he was always big, strong Kris Kristofferson to me. You know, I always thought he was
indestructible. Strong,
yeah. I mean, the Willie Nelson thing, I think somebody mentioned earlier on, it might have been on Claire Byrne earlier on, that Willie Nelson will be here forever. You know, he's not going anywhere. It's just, he's in. But I kind of felt the same about Kris Kristofferson. So it was striking to see him not at his strong best.
Right.
But the amazing thing was, I suppose my main point was, when he started to sing his set, it was like he was, it was 30 years ago, he was still vibrant and strong and engaging in the whole business. But later on that evening, when he was singing with Barbara, he was frail, and he was, I would have thought, kind of disorientated. It was quite sad to see that, yeah.
All right,
but I was so proud to see him, you know, in 2019, before the thing happened. That would have been my last opportunity to see him, and thankfully I got to.
Great memories to hold with you today on the day when you hear of his passing. Yeah. Liz Murrow Carroll, Kris Kristofferson, you saw him live and unwittingly almost met him.
Yeah, that's true.
What happened?
What happened was I had two tickets for the dress circle in front of myself and my friend. And she was a real Northern Ireland, real piercing voice. And I said to her, I'm going out for a smoke. And she said, oh, Les, don't, you know. But I went and I said, I'm not going down all those steps all the way down to the front. So I went to push bar to open. And I'm standing out there having a smoke. And the next thing I heard this voice saying, are you enjoying the show? And I said, oh, Jesus, I tell you, if I had my way, I'd pull him off that stage and he'd go home with a smile on his face. And he said to me, what? I'm Kris Kristofferson. Jesus Christ. And I nearly ate the cigarette. And he said, would you like me to sing something for you? And I said, oh, yeah, I love that one, Jodie and the Kid. Excuse me. So I went back out and she says, Les, where were you? You're gone about 15 minutes. And I said, I was out talking to Kris Kristofferson. She said, oh, will you go away? Well, I wouldn't like to use the language that she said on the, you know. And he came back out again and he said that he sang a couple of songs. And then he said, this is especially for Liz. Said it was the best offer I've had in a long time. Only when I'm here with my daughter, I'd take her up on it. And he sang Jodie and the Kid for me. So there you go. And that was my.
And has your friend from the north picked her jaw up off the floor yet?
Lord bless her. She's dead now, but it was just so funny.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm sorry to hear about your friend, and it's a nice memory to have of her on the day we hear of Kris Kristofferson's sad passing. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that with us, Liz.
No problem.
Back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Call him on one guy in here. You can get us by text on 51551. Now, we spent a good bit of the programme so far talking about Kris Kristofferson, obviously, but the role of Good Samaritans in Kris Kristofferson's life. Johnny Cash giving him a leg up. Steve Goodman and John Prine benefiting from Kris Kristofferson, obviously, along with the merits of their own songs, but clearly getting a helping hand as well. But Killian Kenny, you've had Good Samaritans of a different sort.
I sure have.
You had quite the adventure.
Yeah, on Thursday of last week, I got my foot caught in the rocks coming back from an island in front of my house in Galway. And two Gardaí, well, they were the first on the scene. Everybody, it seems, was called out from helicopter, Doolin Rescue, Galway Bay, the RNLI, and the fire brigade, ambulance, and guards, of course.
And how did you tell us how you ended up getting your foot caught between a rock for these guards to need to rescue you?
Well, I pick mussels in an area of the bay. There's a little island out in the frontier near the castle, and I was out the other side of the island, and I saw that the tide was coming in fast, and I should not bother with the mussels, just go home. And I was making my way back across. There's a little causeway goes across from the island to the mainland. And I was walking over that and I stood to the left thinking I was standing on higher ground and my foot went down between the rocks and I had big wellies on me. So it stayed down.
And no way of getting the foot out of the welly. This is in Kinvara, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know the area you're talking about. The foot was stuck in the welly between the rocks.
That's right. And I couldn't twist it nor pull it nor get any purchase on it, you know, to raise myself out of it.
And were you nervous about breaking the leg or twisting the ankle if you went too hard at it?
No, I had I had the phone, and I had every confidence, not foolishly, but I had every confidence that I would be helped out, that assistance would come to my aid, as it did, in the persona two Gardaí, Randall Considine and Shane Liddell, came down like a bat out of hell from the local station. I believe it's about 10 miles away.
Right,
they got the call.
You had the phone with you, did you?
I had the phone in my pocket, in my trouser pocket, and the water wasn't even up to that. And I said, I'd better take that out of there, it'll get wet. And I put it in my top pocket, and then it seemed within minutes the water was in my top pocket as well, and I up over the water, which I did all the time.
And how far? So the guards were out of the station in Gort, were they?
They were. Yeah.
And I think Gort to Kinvar is about 16 minutes on the road, but then they also have to get out to you in the causeway. So, I mean, you made the phone call when the water was up around your knees, did you?
I did.
And yeah, where was it by the time the guards arrived?
Up to over my shoulders. The guards, Randall Considine, who got me out, went down under the water and freed the boot. And then he said, just keep your head tilted back, because the water at that stage was up to my chin. Really.
Was he under the water to free your foot?
Well, it seemed like seconds, but I don't know. You know, maybe it was a quick process for him, but to say I couldn't get the strength to do it. I could not manoeuvre myself out. But he came over, got down under the water, freed thing, and then told me, lie on my back, and he'd swim me in, as he did, swam me into the bank.
Back to Kinvara or back to the island?
Back into the bay, to the mainland from the island. It's a relatively short distance, but when the water's up around your neck, it's not the length of it, as they say. You know, I forget what they say about it. What they used to say about roads, that it wasn't the length of it, but the width of it that mattered.
Right.
Yeah, so, and at that stage,
hats off to the two Gardaí.
Well, indeed, and everybody else, because they were the first down. I believe that when I phoned the rescue, the Coast Guard, that everybody, Doolin Rescue, Galway RMLI, and the fire brigades, ambulance and guards, they were all tasked, as they call it, and the guards got me out onto the bank where the firemen were there, and they brought me in. And then there was a woman whose name is Annette, I don't know her surname, but her partner is in the RNLI in Galway. And she said that they got a call, and her partner rang her when they got the call, because she lives only a mile up the road. And she was down before anybody else. She was down on the road when I was taken back out and provided the heat for me.
Well,
you know, I really provided heat. You know?
Well, it's a good thing you live to tell the tale, and fair play to you for coming on air anyway and expressing the gratitude to all concerned. Thanks very much, Killian.
Well, it's all I could do is express gratitude. You know, because they were heroes. Every one of the life saving people are in deserve of commendation, but in particular, Randall Considine and Shane Little.
Okay, Killian, thanks very much. We're going to wrap today, and it's just to go back to Chris Christopherson, who supported Sinead O'Connor during the backlash against her protest when she tore up the picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live. She later took to the stage at a concert in Madison Square Gardens to celebrate Bob Dylan's birthday, and she was being booed by the crowd. Chris Christopherson went out to get her off the stage. He was sent out to get her off the stage, but instead he put an arm around her and whispered in her ear, saying, "Don't let the so-and-sos get you down." Non illegitime carborundum, to put it in its Latin form. And he wrote this song for her sister Sinead in 2009. That's our lot. Mark McGrath was on sound. The broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. Today's programme was produced by Owen McLaughlin. I'm Colm O'Munga, and Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Their new autumn range will leave you bursting with ideas. View in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.